From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point.
New York, New York, New York, New York. It's a hell of a town. We've got one day here and not another minute to see the famous sights.
We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it beneath the Broadway lights.
Oh, we've hair on our chest.
The 1944 musical On the Town is back on Broadway and getting wonderful reviews. The story about three unworldly sailors during World War II trying to experience New York in a day is full of antics, romance, song, and dance. The story about how the show came into being is pretty good, too. We'll hear it. This hour, On Point, the making of the Broadway hit On the Town. You can join us on air or online. Have you seen On the Town? What makes it still sing 70 years later? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Adam Green, the son of Adolf Green, one of the creators of On the Town. But first, joining me now from New York is Ben Brantley, chief theater critic for the New York Times. You can read his review of On the Town on our website, onpointradio.org. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Hello.
I got the feeling you liked this show.
Did that come across?
Yes, it did. Tell me what's great about it.
It's so hard not to like it. It's one of those shows that really does make you feel you're dancing along with the cast. I mean, it's that transporting. And I was a little worried about it when I heard it was coming to Broadway, because I'd seen an earlier version at the Barrington Stage Company, a small regional theater in Massachusetts during the summer, and it was great summertime entertainment, but I thought, how the heck are they going to expand that to fill a big Broadway stage like the Lyric has? But they do, and without a whole lot of contrivance, it just feels incredibly fresh. And it's about, you know, the mating instinct. It's three sailors who are on the town looking for girls.
As you said in the lead of your piece, it's a sex story you can take your kids to.
Well, exactly. It makes it seem, well, as it should, you know, wholesome. There's nothing seedy about it. I think I also said if it's leering, it's the leer of an angel. It's what musicals can do. They can take, you know, our not basest, but most primal impulses and translate them into something kind of exalted. And it also, when I saw, I felt this when I saw it in Massachusetts, too. And I'd seen earlier revivals that hadn't quite taken. But this one, it made you think how fresh it must have seemed when it was first performed 7 decades earlier.
Well, what I found interesting was, well, first of all, I want to ask you whether you think that quality is something that is rare on Broadway right now, given sort of where our culture has gone in those 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the original, as I was reading about it was sort of crackling for audiences back then and was something a little more raw than they were used to, although they loved it. It wasn't like they reacted against it, but it seemed like it was bracing for that time and still kind of fresh enough for this time.
Yeah, well, of course it was. It must have seemed racy. But every generation tends to think it's invented sex, or at least a consciousness of sex. You know, they didn't say those things back then. Well, of course they did. And when you had a team that was as young and sort of with it as Comden and Green and Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins were, they, of course, that was what they talked about. That's what young people talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it is hard to, I mean, we tend to condescend often, I think, in revivals of period pieces, like, isn't it quaint? And for so long, we had a culture that put things like this in quotation marks. This has no quotation marks. It, I think, updates it a little bit. I think there are lines that probably weren't in the original that are just a little bit racier, but it doesn't patronize the show in any way, and it does make you feel like we're in 1944, and it's a randy, slightly raunchy, but very exciting time, very fresh and innocent at the same time.
People talk about movie remakes or sequels as sometimes being pale imitations of the original. Is that usually true on the stage, and does that make this one an exception?
I think there have been some marvelous revivals over since I've been in the job, including what's become one of the longest running musicals on Broadway, the revival of Chicago, which is still around. And that was a show that didn't quite work in its time, but somehow seemed to fit into the more cynical era in which it was reborn, which would have been the mid 1990s. As I said, that's still around. So I do think there, you just need to approach and the Bartlett Schur's revival of South Pacific at Lincoln Center, I think, did much the same thing. But it's obviously not an easy formula to achieve, or else every revival we see would feel this fresh.
Well, and in fact, the revivals in 1971 and in the late 1990s were not big commercial hits at that time.
No, I didn't see the one in the early 1970s, but I did see the more recent one, which was a noble attempt to make it, quote, relevant, to show, you know, a grittier melting pot New York. But it tried too hard. And also, crucially, lacked the great choreography, because On the Town was based on a short ballet by Jerome Robbins, Fancy Free. Mm-hmm. And dance is so essential. The exhilaration of dance, the translation of, erotic impulses, wonder, and the just pure adrenaline of New York into dance and graceful dance is essential. And I do think that's been done in this revival, and it's key to it. It's got, I think, the best dancing on Broadway right now.
Now, both Jerome Robbins and Leonard Bernstein, of course, became huge forces in the American arts. What role did this show at the dawning of their careers play in their development and their emergence?
Well, I think it showed them as sort of bicultural figures, as it were, artists who could work both in the popular vernacular, but also in more sort of what we like to think of as high art idioms. They would continue to work both on the Broadway stage and in concert halls. So it's rare that you get people who can function so persuasively in two different levels of art. Although I wouldn't say, in my own opinion, that one's that much higher than the other. But I think you saw them from the beginning as double threats in that sense, people who could conquer two kinds of territory.
Let me ask you a business related question that goes to the commercial viability of this show and others on Broadway. We've seen in the part of media that you and I work in, the New York Times, that the digital revolution has created tremendous challenges for print newspapers. It's created tremendous challenges for the television industry. What about the stage? How viable as an economic force is Broadway right now? And has the fact that we're all looking at entertainment on small devices that we carry around in our pocket, is that a huge problem for them as it is for newspapers, say?
Well, in theory, I think theater has a great advantage over, say, television and film, in that it is live. That's the draw of it. You're seeing something recreated before your eyes, fresh, every night by real people like you. And we're so used to looking at, quote, real people on screens, in which they appear rather self-conscious, especially if it's a so-called reality show.
Reality television, yeah.
Right. That if you actually I would think that I'm hoping that there's going to be a point at which people say, but wait a minute, we can see this. This is the real thing. This is something that's happening as it's happening. That may be from a script, but nonetheless, it's being invented on the spot. So in that sense, I think it's an advantage. I know that marketing people in theater have tried to make use of, you know, Twitter with social media to disseminate enthusiasm, to get people to respond. And I actually saw a musical last night in which the audience contributes the plot, the title, the song titles, and even the score. or via their cell phone. So that's, I think, probably a one-off sort of novelty show. But there is an awareness that this needs to be addressed. On the other hand, what has allowed theater to endure and survive the onslaughts of various technologies is the fact that it remains purely live.
What is the median run for a Broadway show? I mean, this show opened in September, I believe. The fact that it's on 2 months later, is that still early in its life, or is that a good run?
That's early in its life. There are shows that are packaged as special events with limited runs and are economically set up so they can recoup in that time their money, especially if they have a big star. I mean, that's the other thing, and it's one reason I hope that people will go to see this en masse, is that traditionally now on Broadway, you do need names to sell musicals. You need brand names. You need people.
Ben Brantley, hold that thought and stay right with us. We're talking about the making of On the Town. You can join the conversation. Were you in a production of On the Town in high school or community theater? What's your favorite scene? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out with Carried Away from the ensemble as performed in 1944. I'm John Harwood for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And when I go to see my friends off on a train, golly, how I hate to see them go. For then my love of traveling I can't restrain. The time has come for parting. The train's already starting. I hop a freight, and in a flash I'm off to Buffalo.
Carried away, carried away.
Gaby's coming to town. So what? Who cares?
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Betty Comden, Adolph Green, and the making of On the Town. You're listening to Lonely Town, sung by John Battles from a cast album recorded in 1960. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine the time, 1944, and how this story of three young sailors became a sensation? Can you imagine what this show meant to Americans struggling through a long war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Ben Brantley, chief theater critic for the New York Times. You can read his review of On the Town at our website, onpointradio.org. And joining me now from New York is Adam Green. He's theater critic for Vogue magazine and contributor to The New Yorker and Vanity Fair. He's the son of Adolph Green, who with Betty Comden wrote the Broadway musical On the Town. They also collaborated on Peter Pan, Bells Are Ringing, and the film Singing in the Rain. Adam Green, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
Adam, let me start by asking you if you agree with Ben Brantley that this is a terrific revival. I note when I was looking at The New Yorker last night, they said they found it overly sentimental. What was your view?
I think it's a terrific revival. The other two that I saw were, I'm afraid, we're a little on the inadequate side. They just didn't work. And in fact,
what's the difference between those two and this one? What is the difference between one that doesn't work and this one that breaks through?
Well, I think Ben really hit on it when he said that it didn't have quotation marks around it. I think it takes it at face value. You know, with it, you know, its flaws and it's wonderful, wonderful, you know, aspects, and it's humor and the romance and the sex, and it doesn't. I don't think it sentimentalizes it at all. And the other big thing is the dancing. It has never been danced like this. When suddenly a dream ballet comes, I'm just I just want to go to sleep myself. And this is it's actually exciting in this version, and it. Tells the story and deepens the understanding of characters. It's just wonderful.
Adam, give us a little bit of the story of your father. I read your piece in Vanity Fair, and it was so interesting to read about his odyssey as a young man and trying to sort of find his way, and he ultimately got into this collaboration that produced such a spectacular result. But talk a little bit about where your dad started and how he got there.
Well, I mean, God, he was born – I mean, I can't believe it. He'd be 100 years old in December. He was born in 1914, at the end of 1914, which is really sort of the beginning of the American century when World War I began, and it was also the year that Charlie Chaplin appeared as the Little Tramp for the first time. And I sort of joked that both of those things – it's hard to know which had a bigger effect on him personally, because Charlie Chaplin was his absolute – idol from boyhood, and then but without World War I, there would have been no World War II, and therefore no On the Town. So it's, I guess, on balance, the two were equally important. He was the son of Hungarian immigrants, grew up in the Bronx. His father was kind of a no-goodnik, was sort of a stock speculator and a bootlegger, and kind of a nasty man. And his mother was sort of a sweet little woman, and they went from lower middle class to kind of middle class for a while, moved to Manhattan when my father was about 10, and then got wiped out by the Depression. And, you know, my father was a sort of a strange, inauspicious young man who he was a fanatic for classical music, silent movies, which – and both – these are both areas that he had a freakish sort of knowledge of, and I think found an escape from the harsh realities of life, as so many other people did at the time. And took him 6 years to graduate high school, and he because he was a terrible student, but he was putting on plays and writing sketches, and you know, he discovered an ability as a performer and someone as a writer. I don't think he ever thought he would do anything with it, and he spent a long time, several years, just being kind of a, as he described himself, a fat, unappealing bum, kind of wandering around, living with his parents.
With talent.
Around New York. Well, he didn't know that he had any talent then. He just was an unhappy guy. He would walk around the city all day long and sort of humming classical pieces to himself, and as he later said, hoping that someone would hear him and join in and, you know, walk with him. And
The anecdote you told in your piece that really broke through was that somebody was testing him and playing a piece on the piano and asking him to identify which Shostakovich piece was being played. And your father responded, I've never heard that piece before, but it's not Shostakovich. And and he turned out to be exactly right.
Well, and that person was Leonard Bernstein, who was who he had just met that, I mean, minutes before that, who, and my father had been brought up by a friend who was a counselor at a summer camp to be in a production of The Pirates of Penzance, and Lenny was the music counselor there. And, you know, it was, I think, a real turning point. That moment was a turning point in my father's life, because he discovered this, you know, he knew instantly that he had met a genius. And the two of them just had – they just found this – all this shared passion. They just walked around the camp all night long, you know, singing each other bits of music and reciting Lewis Carroll and poems by Auden and just – you know, and singing Gershwin songs. And it just – you know, I think
– somehow, you know, I don't see that happening on the streets of New York today.
This was not in New York. This was in a summer camp up in the Berkshires.
Okay.
But but what I know that my father just, you know, wrote that it was a, you know, it was, he said it was like meeting him was like suddenly feeling the fresh air of a million windows opening simultaneously, and that his whole life had been building toward that moment. And in fact, that night, my father's sang for Lenny Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, which Lenny hadn't heard, sang him the entire thing. And when On the Town happened, there was a little private joke between them, because if you listen in the first movement of Sibelius's symphony, there's the main four-note figure is bum, 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 New York, New York. And it's the same notes.
All right.
And it was
Adam, let me ask you about Betty Comden, because yes, many people have heard of Jerome Robbins and, of course, Leonard Bernstein, but not so much Betty. How did he come to be her collaborator?
They met, I think, someone, you know, they met through a mutual friend. Betty was about to graduate from NYU. My father was still a bum, but although he had met Lenny and he was trying very quixotically to become an actor, which was definitely not in the cards. He was a wonderful performer, but he was, again, a peculiar-looking young man. And they met, and my father also had met – I mean, this is all in the period of a year – met a young girl named Judy Holliday, and who had gotten – she met a guy named Max Gordon, who owned a nightclub called the Village Vanguard in Greenwich Village. And he said, do you have any friends? Do you want to – you know, we need a show for Sunday night. And somehow they put together a show, and it took a while, but they suddenly discovered this. They had this talent for writing, for performing, and there was a great review, as often happens, a great review in the New York Times. And suddenly they showed up at the nightclub, and there was lines around the block to get in, and they started getting very fancy audiences. And then Lenny came down right after he'd graduated Harvard, and he and my father lived together in apparently horrible squalor on 9th Street. I think they destroyed an apartment. And Lenny just was sort of knocked out by this whole thing, and he became a repository of knowledge. The group was called The Reviewers, and they did satirical songs and sketches, and I think Lenny even wrote
an early version of Saturday Night Live.
Perhaps. I mean, yes, there was no TV, although The Reviewers did do an early – they were on an early version of TV that could only be seen on some closed-circuit things. But they did a radio show for about 6 months, and it lasted for several years and kind of never – eventually never sort of petered out. Out on the West Coast, they were in a movie called Greenwich Village, a really dismal B picture, and Judy Holliday got a contract with 20th Century Fox, and my father didn't, and so he came home, and in what has become a sort of famous story, he was miserable on a train home and to New York, and with no prospects and no money, and he had nowhere to live, and Betty met him at the at Grand Central Station with a sign saying Adolf Green Fan Club, which is a moment that they then used in a movie called The Bandwagon.
Adam, I want to bring Ben Brantley back in because, Ben, you were talking before the last break about the role of big-name stars in Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. I, if I'm not mistaken, both Brando and Kirk Douglas tried – out for roles in the original Broadway show, didn't get them. Is it more or less important now to have big famous names on Broadway? And are Broadway shows cast in the same way now that they were in the 1940s?
Probably not. I mean, there were famous names always, of course, but they were names that were associated principally with theater. And names associated exclusively with theater are not probably widely known by the American public. I mean, you've got people like Nathan Lane, perhaps, who has had success in other mediums as well. But generally, yeah. And the problem is that you have to recruit people from outside the sphere of Broadway, people whose natural talents are not necessarily to the stage. So you bring in names from the big screen. And I think it's cool that these people want to do it. It sort of raises the hip quotient of Broadway. But they aren't always ideally suited to it. And, I mean, I can't think of anyone who could have played Gaby as well as Tony Yazbek, although I may be mistaken, who would be a big Hollywood name, who would be someone you'd see, on TMZ or the cover of Us.
I want to bring in now Josh Bergas from New York. He's a dance teacher and choreographer. He was choreographer for NBC's musical series Smash, which ran from February 2012 to May 2013. And he is the choreographer for the On the Town production now on Broadway. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
Let me ask you something. I understand that choreographic instructions for this production, were the original, were not written down. And I don't know if that is unusual or not, but how do you, as someone brought in for revival, reimagine the choreography, or do you make it up all de novo?
Well, that's right. They weren't written down, so we kind of had to reimagine it. But we did that with Jerome Robbins' style in mind, and trying to I would often say to myself, "What would Jerry do?" And
is that an intimidating thing for someone like you?
It can be very daunting. It's a very big project. There's a lot of dance, but I think what makes it easier almost is the amount of dance that's in this show, because dance is used as a storytelling vocabulary in this show. And so you use the story as your guide to the choreography, and you know, you know, if the choreography is right, then the story will be right, and vice versa.
Ben Brantley,
Ben Brantley here. I just have a question. How much did you go back to Fancy Free?
You know, actually, somebody asked me that question last night. I actually didn't much. I know Fancy Free. I'm familiar with it, but I didn't want to copy that because I felt, I didn't want to go there with that.
Ben, let me ask you, do film versions exist of all prior productions of shows like this? And is it customary for someone doing a revival to study how it's done? Or would they rather sort of approach it with a clear way of thinking and not be overly influenced by a prior choreographer or producer's work?
Well, I think that's more for Joshua to answer than me. But yeah, and you can find, there's a wonderful treasure trove at the part of the New York Public Library, the Library of Performing Arts Theater on Film and Tape Archive, that has, they weren't recording full productions as far as I know in the 1940s on film, but since the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of Broadway shows have been put on tape. I think, what I liked so much about the choreography here is that it captured the spirit of Robbins, and we've certainly, those of us who have been around for a while are certainly aware of his work, and in the ballet too. But it seemed tailored also to this cast, this performers, this particular production. And what was so great for me about the dance is that everyone danced with his or her own personality. They were all doing the same steps, but you were aware of the individuals in it too. And that's the ideal, I think, if when you're doing a revival, not just to religiously resurrect it step by step, but to hold on to its spirit and make it seem relevant and fresh to a new audience.
Josh, did you study film at the archive that Ben just referred to?
I did go to see the last revival a couple years ago, so I had a reference. I didn't want to study too much because I didn't want to get too in my head about it and then compare what I was doing to what they did and wonder if I was doing it right or wrong. Sometimes it can be a block for an artist to do that. So, and as to what Ben said, it was a very collaborative effort with the dancers and especially, our three sailors and their three girls to make sure that they felt that they were telling the right story through the choreography and through their dancing and their movements. Because they're the ones who have to perform it every night, and they're the ones who have to take that emotional journey and tell that story. So if it wasn't feeling right for them, then we would reevaluate what they were doing.
Sure.
and find the right story for them.
Josh Bergas, choreographer for the new On the Town production, thanks for joining us. Also, Ben Brantley, chief theater critic for the New York Times, thank you. Adam Green, please stand by. We're talking about the making of the Broadway hit On the Town. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out with Lucky to Be Me from the production on Broadway.
I'm so proud you chose me from all the crowd. Could laugh out loud. I'm so lucky to be me.
Oh, I the best in the town. Yeah, I can cook too. My fish can't be beat. My sugar's the sweetest around. I'm a man.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the creation of the Broadway show On the Town. I Can Cook Too is a favorite from On the Town. Alicia Umfress sings it in the production now on Broadway. You can join our conversation. You wish you could have been there with Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Betty Comden, and Adolph Green dreaming up the story, the lyrics, the dancing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Adam Green, theater critic for Vogue magazine and contributor to The New Yorker and Vanity Fair. He's the son of Adolph Green, who with Betty Comden wrote the Broadway musical On the Town. Now, Adam, let me ask you one question about 5 years after the original production went to Broadway. There was a Hollywood movie with Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra, which may be how large portions of the American public became acquainted with On the Town. But my understanding is that your father loathed the movie version. Why was that?
Maybe loathed. Well, it either is or isn't too strong, or I'm not sure. The movie had one great, great thing in it. The opening sequence of doing New York, New York, despite changing a hell of a town to Wonderful Town, because a hell of a was, I guess, considered too racy.
Hell of a back then?
Well, not in films, not at MGM. But despite that, it was shot on location, and it's a spectacular opening sequence. But they got rid of most of Bernstein's music, most of the original songs, and the story was kind of sanitized, and it just felt kind of effortful rather than fancy free, so to speak. And it was my father was always a little ashamed of it. In fact, when I was a kid and it came on television, he came and turned it off, and I didn't really see it until I was in college.
All right, we want to go to one of our callers. Mary is on the line from Avon, Connecticut. Mary, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Thank you. It was a turning point in my life to see that show. I was a teenager, and what my question is, how did they find that wonderful collection of performers? Nancy Walker. And I believe the beautiful young lady who was the star was Sono Osato.
Correct.
And could Adam perhaps remember what his parents said about how they found that group of people who were such wonderful performers?
Thanks so much, Mary. Adam, go ahead.
Well, I know that part of the time when they were writing the show, my father and Betty and Lenny and Jerry Robbins were out. They were out in Hollywood because Fancy Free was being done there, and they had a very short time to write the show. I mean, it was from the conception of the show to opening night was 6 months. And Nancy Walker, who was about 22, was just sort of becoming a star, and they all were fans of hers. And she came over and they played her a song and asked her, would she play this, you know, this sort of sex-starved lady cab driver? And she said yes on the spot. And so they wanted her. That's they had seen her. And I think Sono Osato was Jerry Robbins' idea. She had made a big splash in One Touch of Venus, I think it was, the year before. And the notable thing about that was that she was, you know, a Japanese-American, and we were still at war in the Pacific. And her father had been in an internment camp. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, we are very lucky right now to have with us from New York the actress, dancer, and director Billy Allen Henderson. She joined the On the Town cast 6 months after it started in 1944 when she was 19 years old. She spent roughly a year with the show on Broadway and on the national tour. Billy Allen Henderson, thanks so much for being with us. And where did the Jerome Robbins, Leonard Bernstein, Adolph Green, and Betty Comden find the amazing Billy Allen Henderson?
Well, my good friend Frank Neal, a dancer, was a dance captain or an associate dance captain from Chicago. And he saw me on the street. Where are you going, girl? Well, I'm just coming out of class and I have some place to go. No, you're coming with me to this audition. Come on, let's go. Jerry's going to like you on the town. I'd seen it. I said, oh, I got very excited. And I went, and that's it. But I was well prepared. I've been studying dance all my life. Even though I was born in Richmond, Virginia, I just knew what I was going to do and where I was going to do it. And I just trained all my life and studied all my life to be able to do this.
Did that show...
That sounds odd, but I would go to ballet school in New York every summer because my mother came to Columbia to do graduate work. And she'd bring me with her. That was my treat. And I'd go to the American School or Ballet Arts or anybody that had a studio and a bar and put out a show. I'd study with them. And that's why I was ready.
Did that show make a significant impact on your career, or was it just one of dozens of shows that you did?
Well, I mean, a lot has happened since then, but it was absolutely a turning point in my life, and I've never been so proud of my country. I've never been so proud of my chosen profession and realizing the power that theater has to inform and to assure and to make changes, and realizing that I've chosen this and we have the power to change.
Was it unusual for a Broadway show to be, a Broadway cast to be as diverse as the On the Town cast was?
Well, there have been other shows that have been diverse, but this was the first time, having grown up in the segregated South, that I was neither, you know, they were all whites only, blacks only, or colors only, and so forth. And I was a New Yorker there. We were all New Yorkers.
Adam, did your father want to make a point and his collaborators want to make a point about diversity, or was that simply a natural casting process?
I don't think it was unusual for the time. I don't know if they were trying to make a large political stand, but I know that what my father said, he was interviewed about it at the time, and you know, he said, he basically said you know, black people belonged to the city, so they belonged in the show. I mean, the show was supposed to reflect the reality of life and of life in New York City. And I think the thing that was also unusual is there weren't black characters. There was no comment being made on race. It was just these were New Yorkers, and that was it. It wasn't written for white or black, you know, singers and dancers. It was just written for singers and dancers. And
all right, we want to go to another one of our callers. We have John on the line from Lexington, Massachusetts. John, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I have a long history with this show. In 1972, I was the music director for a college production, despite the fact that I did not know how to conduct. And this was Bernstein, so that wasn't easy.
Yeah, you shouldn't let a little thing like that get in your way.
Well, I tried not to. I played it again. I played in a pit orchestra in graduate school and fell in love with the cellist in the orchestra at that time, but that's another story. But what I really wanted to bring out was the impact that this show has had on jazz, even though these are not well-known tunes in the world of jazz as the jazz musician today. But Bill Evans, who was just one of the great pianists of jazz, he at least did Lonely Town and Lucky to Be Me and Some Other Time. And in fact, Some Other Time, his intro to that, which is really just two chords, just a little kind of suspended chord that he sat on, he kind of got into that intro, just these two chords over and over, and that became yet another one of his probably most famous of those tunes called Peace Peace, which was really inspired by his own intro to Some Other Time. These are just beautiful, beautiful pieces, and it's kind of a shame to me that this work isn't better known just because the music is just so great.
John, thanks so much. Adam, do you perceive the influence on jazz that John was just talking about?
On jazz, I don't know. I mean, it's to me, you know, the the music for the show, Bernstein's music is just, you know, it's just so gorgeous. And it's the...
That's why I can't imagine really, the movie producers not using it.
They just thought it was too highfalutin because it was a very it was written symphonically. I mean, if you listen to it, it's through composed. I mean, there are themes that show up at the beginning that are, you know, that there are variations on them throughout the show. It is through composed the way a symphony is, and there were no shows before that that did it, and very few since then, other than West Side Story, which is also happens to be by Leonard Bernstein.
All right, we want to go to another caller. We've got Jane on the line from St. George, Vermont. Jane, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. My father produced the revival from 1971 on Broadway, Jerry Schlossberg. So I was like a puppy dog hanging around watching the production being put on. Unfortunately, it was not very successful. It lasted only 73 performances, but I got to meet Adolph Green and Bernadette Peters and everyone. And I was just wondering what... does Adolph Green's son, if he's on the air, what did his father think of that production? It was really great. And
thanks so much, Jane. Adam, what do you think?
My mother, his wife, was in that production, so I know he was very proud of that. And I think I was a little boy, and my main memory of that production was Bernadette Peters was in it, and I think she was probably 19 or 20 at the time, and my father took me backstage to meet her, and I knocked on her dressing room door and opened it, and without waiting for an answer, and there she was, completely naked, and it was—I'll tell you—one of the great moments of my life. So that's mostly, and I remember seeing my mother. My critical faculties were not in full play at the time, but I mean, I adored it that much. I remember
Billy Allen Henderson. What was your favorite tune in the show, and do you remember the was there a particular moment of your performance that really stands out?
Well, I was just wowed by and overcome and inoculated with the music. I'd never heard such wonderful orchestrations. I've always been, you know, into orchestrations. I practically know the through line of every instrument in this show. And it is just wonderful to hear it with the original orchestrations and a pit band ready to play this music. I mean, it's absolutely thrilling. And, of course, there's just so many and so many bridges that I love. The entrance to Dream Subway, you know, that breathing in and out and that oboe solo that goes in there to tie it all together. It's just an incredibly imagined, not only imagined, but realized piece. And this music is outstanding.
Adam, let me ask you about a development that's occurred in the last couple of years at NBC, which is the return as a way of trying to build audience of live theater. They put on live Sound of Music last winter. This Correct. Winter, they're going to put on Peter Pan, which is a show that your father was also involved with. Do you like that development? Do you think that serves the pieces and the would you like to see more of it?
Sure. I mean, this is a way of, you know, bringing these, you know, musicals to a much larger public. And Peter Pan itself, it was on. First on Broadway, but then it was broadcast three times on NBC. I think in 1954 or five, and then twice, and then later in the 50s again, and then in the early 60s, and it was done three separate times. And so that show in particular has a history of that. But sure, it's you know, introducing more people to musical theater and having it not be just this exotic, you know, species that is surely a good thing.
Billy Allen Henderson, how would you feel today as a performer about doing a stage play on live television?
On the town, I would feel absolutely heavenly bound, especially if my 90-year-old body. It's still...
Somehow I suspect you could still do it.
Not even when my body responds kinesthetically to the orchestrations and to the music every time I hear it. And it really has carried me through my life in all kinds of situations and in all kinds of atmosphere. I remember seeing the reviews when I was a little girl. My sister lived down in the West Village, and she would take me to the Vanguard sometimes because she had to. And I'd see these wonderful performers, you know, and I could imagine them working it out at this camp in the Berkshires and having all that time to spend together, and they were just zany and crazy and talented.
I wish I could have been there.
Billy Allen Henderson, yeah. All I can say is from the passion that I hear in your voice, I really, really would like to see some of your performances. And I thank you so much for joining us today. Adam Green, theater critic for Vogue magazine, son of Adolf Green, and one of the creators of On the Town, thank you so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to go out here with Tony Bennett's rendition of Some Other Time, which is a piece in the show. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
There's so much more embracing still to be done, but time is racing. Oh, well, we'll catch up some other time.